Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series, the last for 2009. We seem to be having a bit of trouble with the sound reinforcement system here, but we'll do the best we can. If I suddenly appear to be shrieking, you'll know what's happened. It's suddenly started to work. In the meantime, we'll just try to speak up. There's been an enormous amount of concern in recent times about ethics in government. You've had the huge scandal in the UK, which has been regarded as institution-destroying almost. And we've had our own little problems here in a certain state, northwards of here and southwards of here, that I won't mention by name. And a few little problems too at the federal level about ethical use of entitlements and so on. This is a very topical issue. For this purpose, we have hunted up a professor of ethics, more or less. Professor Charles Samford is, as you can see from the screen, the director of a joint institute on ethics and government devoted to the pursuit of problems in this area. And he has some very interesting views. Please welcome him to the podium.
Thanks very much, Harry. It's a pleasure to be here. Whenever he talks about political ethics, I must say I started off in doing work in business ethics about just over 20 years ago, and there are lots of jokes about political ethics, and I've heard most of them and may have even created a few of them. People say it's an oxymoron. Some might say you're going to talk on political ethics. Well, that'll be a short speech. Maybe you expect me to come along, the sceptics expect me to come along and say, political ethics, humph, and then sit down. There would then be three questions, of course. Harry, why did you invite someone to talk about this non-existent topic? Charles, why did you waste your time coming to talk about it, and how can you possibly claim to write about it? And to the audience, well, why did you come here either? But of course, not only did Harry invited me, not only did I come, but also we actually had an audience of Canberrans and politicians and former politicians, so obviously some people think that means something. Of course, there might be some slightly longer speeches. 20 years ago, if I'm taking as my leitmotif for a couple of reasons, you'll see why, he might have given Senator Richardson might have been invited along, and he would have given a very short speech, which is whatever it takes. Although one of the problems with the philosophers, and I am, for my sins, partly a lawyer, partly a philosopher, partly a political scientist. I've been interested in the vortex where the three meet, and we now call it governance, but when I started in 72 as an undergraduate student in all three disciplines, I just thought it was an exciting place to be. One of the problems with the philosopher part of me is that you say, well, actually you may have more sophisticated ethical views than you think. Not very sophisticated ethical views, but more sophisticated. Because if you say whatever it takes, then in that case you're actually saying, well, whatever it takes to do what? You've obviously got some criteria for, they're only about ends. You're saying it's about me. It's forget about the means. It's all about the ends. But that itself means that you have to make ethical choices about ends. It's something that I always used to laugh when people talked about pragmatism and meaning you didn't have to think about ethics. Well, actually, if you say, well, whatever works or whatever it takes does involve an essential question of what does it count to work? What are you doing whatever it takes to achieve? But again, I think the thing is that most people would like to have a slightly larger role for ethics than either of those first two kinds of speeches. Of course, the third thing, if this is 20 years ago, I'm talking about invitations to give lectures on political ethics, the last thing, and probably you'd be even less likely to invite somebody from Queensland to give a lecture on political ethics than you would have the then famous Senator Richardson. Because 20 years ago, there was a number of problems in Queensland. In fact, I'd say Queensland was the butt of even more ethical jokes than politicians generally. And, of course, there's another thing. You wouldn't have invited me to come from Queensland because, although I was born in Queensland, at that point I had absolutely no intention of going back. When I said many years later, Tony Fitzgerald became a good friend, and he was the first chair of our advisory board going back to 1992. And I said, I never would have come to Queensland without you. And he did say, that's one responsibility I'll never bear. But I certainly wouldn't have dreamt of going to Queensland, and so I wouldn't have dreamt of coming to talk about it. On the other hand, I was talking a lot about ethics. In fact, at that stage, I was in the middle of establishing the first university-based Centre of Applied Ethics in Australia. If I may be permitted one of several digressions I'll take during this talk. I had actually, the reason why I was setting up the philosophy department is I'd gone to my then Dean of Law and said, wouldn't it be a wonderful idea to set up a Centre of Law and Ethics? And I waxed lyrical for about a minute or so, and he said, there's no money in it. I must admit, the thing is that this was one of the more important moments in my academic career, because I did disagree with him, both on normative grounds and on empirical grounds. Firstly, that is not the basis on which you judge academic endeavours, whether there's money in it. The second, I thought, is empirically, it was just dead wrong, that there was money in it. And one of the things that I'm more notorious for is that I've raised something like $15 to $20 million on ethics and governance research. In fact, I've headed the only law-based research centre to receive national IRC funding. So, funnily enough, there was money in it. But you probably gathered that was not the least reason why I was actually doing it. But it was actually a real spur, because I said, well, if you think, I just think you're wrong, and I'm going to bloody well prove that you're wrong, which means that even among ethicists, there's sometimes a bit of sort of personal motivation comes in here. Anyway, 20 years ago, there was a lot of talk about ethics, because, of course, that was the time of the time when we'd actually had the 87 crash. We had a lot of over-leveraged entrepreneurs. Sort of sounds familiar, except the entrepreneurs of the 80s were at least actually producing beer and building hotels. But, of course, the thing is that... I must admit, the thing is that I always a bit sceptical about bubbles bursting, and astonishingly, I was astonished by efficient markets theory when I first read about it at that particular time. When inevitably the overleveraged entrepreneurs fell as the overleveraged financial innovators fell so recently, Galbraith's quip was always that the definition of a financial genius is somebody who's reckless during a boom. And so we've had quite a few of those over the time, and I suppose some of us saw it coming and some of us thought we'd talk about it afterwards. There was, of course, the W.O. Inc., there was the Moonlight State, and then there was the state that surrounds you, that Harry was referring to, which I think that it's, although some people think that it's gone down since the Rum Core, I'm one of those people who believes it has actually marginally improved, which is actually quite important in terms of a theory of integrity systems, which I won't go into. Now, at the time, there were a lot of different responses to these problems. So there was both political problems of political meltdown, ethical meltdown, and business ethical meltdown. And people were pretty miserable about the thing, and of course Australia actually did rather badly out of that particular recession. And there was a lot of soul-searching about what we should do. And in fact, there was, at the time, I think it was at H.L. Mencken's great quote, struck me as quite significant. To every complex problem, there is always a simple solution. I don't know how many of you know the next line, and it's always wrong. But in fact, actually, in the late 1980s, as so often in these things, in fact, H.L. Mencken actually himself was wrong. There weren't actually one simple solution. In fact, there were three simple solutions which various people from various disciplines and interests would push. The first, of course, is a natural thing. People have done wrong, get tougher laws, convict them and throw away the key. Sometimes people even don't want the tougher laws or the convictions and just throw away the key first, but we live in a society of the rule of law, so it means tougher laws for next time, unfortunately. But the problem was that if you actually just have tougher laws, it's always said that laws in conflict with the values and norms of those it's regulated will be ineffective. That was why a lot of people sort of believed, well, okay, we need ethics to sort of teach them to be good. And others insisted on new institutions, ICACs, ombudsmen, FOI, auditors, and parliamentary committees. In fact, ethics, though, was particularly popular at the time. Not quite sure why. I think because most people realised that the people had too many good lawyers to go to jail, or for many of them to go to jail. And ethics was very popular. And actually, a Four Corners journalist asked me at the time, "Gee, all these people talking about ethics. Are you setting up this ethics institute? Is there a sea change?" To which my response was, probably not a sea change, more like a tidal movement, wait until the market's up again. Although I think there's a, I'm not quite as cynical as that. I actually have a view that you should ride scandals. Normally you get change when there's a significant scandal. I'll talk about probably one of the biggest there's been. Don't expect you'll perfect the system. But sort of be ready with suggested changes, try to drive through change as far as you can so that with that tidal movement, it moves up, it'll move back. But hopefully it won't move back quite so far next time, and maybe you'll be able to push it a little bit further. And that's the difference of the approach. But it doesn't mean you need to be ready when the scandals actually strike. But I think that in talking about ethics, something I really want to emphasise, partly it's because I claim to be a lawyer, a political scientist, and sometimes self-taught economist, I don't believe that ethics can do it all by itself. I think there's one sort of image of ethics that it's about teaching people to be good and that'll be sufficient. And there's a particular version of this, which is that what we should do is to train people to be what I see as saints, those who do the right thing, whatever the pressure, whatever the cost. I'm not so optimistic that we can actually train enough saints to fill a cabinet room, let alone to sort of, you know, man every police car. I used to say police beat, but I realised I was a bit old-fashioned, and to fill the roles in every social security desk. We're never going to be able to train enough saints. And the key is not to train enough saints. And even if you did train saints, I'm not at all sure that they'd get elected. I'm not going to say one shouldn't elect them, but it's actually quite possible that they wouldn't be. And the most saintly people I know probably wouldn't fit very well into politics, even as reconstructed as I would hope it might be. And this is what I've always said, is that the goal is not to train people to be saints, but to design institutions that don't need saints to run them. It means you don't ignore ethics. Ethics, as I'll show, is, in my view, an absolutely critical part of good governance. But I am as contemptuous of anybody who talks about what, in fact, I call it bare ethics, where you think ethics will do it just by itself. I think that's foolish, it's misguided. I will attack anyone who says it because it actually gives ethics a bad name, because people say, aha, you tried ethics. It failed. It will fail if it's actually done by itself and without any other elements. In fact, the approach that I took, a friend of mine called it a trilogy and then realised that a trilogy is in sequence rather than combined, and he changed it to the word trinity. That in fact, that if you want to deal with governance problems, which are sometimes seen as legal problems, sometimes seen as ethical problems, and sometimes seen as institutional problems, but are generally all three, what you need is a combination of ethical standard setting, legal regulation, and institutional reform. And by institutional reform, I'm not only talking about political structures, but ensuring the economic incentives within them drive people in the right direction. I've always argued that ethics has actually a dual role. Firstly, it's part of the Trinity. It's one of the three critical ways of achieving governance reform. But also it has a coordinating role, in that it helps to, because it's no good just saying we'll have ethics, laws and institutional reforms if the two of them are not coordinated or brought in sync, as we used to say 20 years ago, but luckily no longer do. Anyone who's a lawyer will know that if you're going to sort of frame laws, it's not just a question of writing the detail. You need principles to help frame them, to help understand them, to help interpret them. That's certainly the best way of trying to write laws. And the ethics can provide, if you like, can provide the basis of those principles. The ethics can also provide standards for judging the success of institutional reform. Because when you engage in institutional reform, well, how do you know that it's succeeded? Well, in that case, you know it because it's fulfilled the values that you've sought to achieve. But then, of course, things. I did become a Queenslander again, because much to my surprise, I was in the midst of all this writing on ethics and setting up an ethics centre in the philosophy department in Melbourne, on loan from the law faculty. Somebody had read one of my articles on legal education, and in fact, the two universities wanted me to be their foundation dean starting at the end of February 1992, and both of them approached me at the end of January 1991. And much to my surprise, my wife agreed to my coming north. She had said at the time she'd live in Melbourne, or Oxford by negotiation. And when somebody rings me up and says, you're interested in studying law school in Brisbane, I said, Melbourne, Oxford by negotiation. And as that was the basis on which, you know, we actually organised our lives, I thought it was a strong ethical principle that that wouldn't be possible. But my wife gave me a dispensation, and we've been there ever since. But of course, at the time, the reason why we had initially wouldn't have dreamt of going to Queensland, why in fact not only was it not on the list of one plus a possible alternative location, we were the complacent South, and I caused the complacent South because Victoria actually thought that it had dealt with its police corruption in a... few of you, I think, are old enough to remember the Beach Report, but in the early 1970s, there was a major report on police corruption into abortion clinics, and that we thought we'd fix up our police, and so we're quite smug about places north, even further north, and places west. And even occasionally when people bashed up gays and dumped them in the Torrens to our west. But in fact, as I say, often the thing is that when you think you don't have a problem, it's because you don't know the problem is there rather than the other way around. So that's where I put in the complacent South. But nonetheless, the thing is, there's no doubt that the Deep North had had the reputation for unethical, freewheeling development. In fact, in many ways, I see it rather similar to Malaysia under Mahathir. Free-willing development, entrenched racism exploited by politicians, the political use of religion, the political use of police. There was a gerrymander, although it was a very strange one because I was amateur cephologist at the time, and a friend and I, during the 1974 election, I think it was, we worked out, well, how many, if there was a uniform swing, this is before Mackerras' concept of a two-party preferred vote, what would a uniform swing produce? And, you know, we suddenly realised if Labor got 50% of the vote in Queensland, they'd be government in the mid-1970s, which sort of struck me as amazing, you know. Then I realised, of course, that the real victims of the gerrymander were not the Labor Party, who were never thought with the DLP, never would have imagined to be in government, but it was actually the Liberals. It's the only way that the minority party of government could actually be the majority party in the parliament if they fixed this gerrymander of almighty proportions against their coalition partners. The other thing, of course, we discovered in the 1980s is that they played very, very fast and loose with their constitution. But of course, there was an absolutely remarkable turnaround. A dramatic example of what can be achieved remarkably quickly from the ethical laughing stock of Australia to what actually became a global model for building integrity and combating corruption. If you go back again to 20 years, remember that the Hong Kong model was the model for fighting corruption. You have a strong ICAC and a strong anti-corruption law. In fact, when Nick Greiner came into power, again, just over 20 years ago in 1989, at the same time the Fitzgerald inquiry was going on, he adopted the Hong Kong model. A number of us had some doubts about it, but what was very interesting was that despite the fact that Fitzgerald was acting at the same time, he had very different ideas. And one of the most... There's an interesting thing about this is that he had an amazing legitimacy. In fact, the thing is that both parties were actually outdoing themselves before, in the lead-up to the 1989 election, to prove that they would implement every reform that Fitzgerald recommended, sight unseen, 100%. In fact, they had various different ways of trying to say 100%, a bit like sort of kids saying, it's 100%, now it's 150%, 200%. And the National Party government even said that they promised they'd implement every Fitzgerald reform sight unseen, lock, stock and barrel. This could have gone to anybody's head, but one of the really interesting things is that instead of saying, I've got all the answers, he suggested that he actually knew the questions, and he suggested a process for answering them. That he had a series of issues about, well, what do we do with the Constitution, what do we do with the electoral reform, what do we do with administrative law, what do we do with public sector ethics, what do we do with the Ombudsman, what do we do with the Constitution, what do we do with Bills of Rights. And he suggested a process where there was an independent commission which commissioned reports, held conferences, took submissions and reported, but very importantly, to Parliament. It wasn't a question, and something I'll emphasise more later on, ultimately going back to Parliament, but it was a process. And one of the really interesting things, almost like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, because these reports kept on coming. Oh, you can improve this, you can improve this, you can improve that. And so that it was very hard for any political party to say, to try and stop the motion, to stop the flow of these reforms. What actually came out was some individual developments that were highly innovative. Some things were just the best they could do was pick, you know, a really good development from somewhere else. For instance, administrative law was almost entirely taken straight from the Commonwealth, which had developed a very good system of administrative law at the time. They did some very important things in ethics and legislative standard setting and public sector reform. But the most interesting thing was the creation of a new model of fighting corruption and building integrity. I called it an ethics regime at the time, and when I was advised the Lord Nolan in England in his Committee on Standards and Public Life, because they had a little problem. The English do, as Harry said, often have their little problems. At that stage, it wasn't electoral allowances, it was free weekends at the Ritz, which was called sleaze. And actually, the funny thing of all was that something that people, Australian politicians were amused by, that they're actually being paid to ask questions in Parliament, which was bizarre, but nonetheless somebody was prepared to do it. So Nolan set up. He liked the idea. He proselytised the Queensland model to the OECD. They called it an ethics infrastructure. And that went on to the UN. But the name that's really stuck and that's become, if you like, the standard model for integrity reforms and fighting corruption around the world has been the concept of a national integrity system. When the first CEO of Transparency International came to Queensland in 1995, he said, this is the answer, and he called it a, quote, national integrity system. He very much pushed it to the World Bank from the late 1990s. The idea is the national integrity system is a set of institutions, processes, people and attitudes working to increase the likelihood that public power is used for officially authorised and publicly justified purposes and not abused for personal or political gain. This is the idea, is that in order to build integrity and reduce corruption, you actually need a series of laws, ethics and institutional reforms. I won't go into a lot of detail about this, but it's become, as I say, the leitmotif. It's replaced the Hong Kong model in the global discussion of anti-corruption and good governance. It's very important, though, although corruption was the problem, he actually didn't call it an anti-corruption system, he called it an integrity system. And this is an important reason it's going to come back to understanding political ethics, is that the point of government is not just to avoid corruption. If you want to avoid government corruption, there is a simple, easy solution. I can tell you how to eliminate all government corruption permanently, instantaneously, overnight. I see some people nodding because they know what the answer is, no government. And I'll tell you what, yeah. Whilst we're on it, we can get rid of corporate corruption at the same time. But whilst this has got an appeal to anarchists of the left or the right, for most people, they say, no, no, no. And they say, why not? Corruption's a terrible thing. They say, well, I want government to deliver security. I want them to deliver education. I want them to be able to get the vaccinations out in three months against swine flu. I want government to do some of these things. So that's the reason why people actually do have government. And the reason why you have government, in fact, the reason why you have all institutions, is there's a belief that by concentrating power, people and resources in government institutions, more can be achieved collectively than by individuals. Such concentrated power allows the achievement of values on behalf of citizens, but of course there's a danger of abuse, because you give people power for one purpose, they might use it for other purposes. So it's a risk that we actually take. And it's only that, accordingly, because there's a danger, and you've got to recognise it's a danger, there are some anarchists who will say, too big a danger, won't take the risk. Those of us who do say we want to take the risk, you say, well, it's only by furthering values of importance to the citizenry that such power can be justified and the risk of abuse be accepted. And also you need to have a system of risk management. I think the emphasis is that integrity systems is a risk management strategy. And as such, of course, you've got to identify integrity risks. It's not necessary to prove that a risk has materialised. I always say that things, you don't insure your house because you know it's going to burn down tomorrow. In fact, if you do try to insure your house because you know it's going to burn down tomorrow, it's probably the only condition under which you will be denied insurance for your house. The point is that there's a risk. Once you identify a risk, you should do something about it. But even then, you treat it like insurance, but like all insurance, there'll be costs. Integrity measures utilise money and talent. And whilst almost always you can ensure a better decision, you've got to be sure that you don't stall decision making completely. In a sense, it's a question of see integrity systems as a risk management strategy. You see that you're giving power to public institutions, to public officials. There is a risk. You try to manage that risk, but you don't want to manage that risk in such a way that you can't actually achieve the result in the end. In one sense, I like to see that the integrity system, which includes actually Parliament, includes parliamentary committees, includes things like the Ombudsman, the Auditor General and so forth, and the courts, the independent prosecutors, see it in terms as a risk management strategy to ensure that it might cost you probably 5% of government expenditure. It's an insurance policy to ensure the other 95% is actually used for the purposes which is intended and claimed, as opposed to abused and used corruptly. So, as I say, it's really important to have a risk management strategy. It also ties in, I think, with a conception of definition of corruption. People define corruption as the abuse of entrusted power for private gain. But again, you say, well, what is an abuse? You have to know how power should be used, what values justify the existence of the power, before you know whether it's an abuse, which leads to the definition of integrity, which is the opposite of corruption. Integrity is using power for the purposes which justify it. And so the real goal, of course, is not just stopping corruption, but actually building integrity. And this has become, if you like, the centre of what we call national integrity systems. There was an important, though, Queensland objection, and that is, and it's pushed very strongly by a former judge called Justice Connolly, who became quite famous in the Connolly-Ryan inquiry. But he actually had what he thought was a highly principled thing. He said, this is undemocratic. You've got all these other bodies. You've got the Ombudsman, and you've got the CJC, is our ICAC. You've got auditors and so forth. You've got all these watchdog bodies. But actually it's undemocratic because they're not elected. And he actually had a very strong version of responsible government, which is not in itself stupid. It basically says that there's this link between this people elect MPs, and the MPs choose their ministers, who choose the Premier, or vice versa. They then appoint the civil servants, they tell the civil servants what to do, and then, of course, depending on what they do is actually agreeable to the people or not, they then go back to elect the MPs. You see, if you introduce any of what people call the fourth arm of government, ombudsman, ICACs and so forth, then this interrupts this. It's actually undemocratic. Of course, the problem with this is that it's so easy to corrupt elements within this. You can gerrymander the electorate, but the link between people and MPs. You can actually get civil servants to do the politicians' bidding as opposed to their public servants' duty, and of course you can engage in a whole series of of ways in which you seek to deceive the people if you've got complete control, if you engage in suing with state funds anybody who disagrees with you. So it's an overly strong version of responsible government. On the other hand, there is actually a point there, in the sense that because the idea of an integrity system involves a series of institutions outside of the parliament, don't think they can substitute for what parliament can do. Parliament, I would argue, must be at the heart of democratic governance. It is the key integrity institution. Of all the integrity institutions that are found within integrity systems, Parliament is the oldest. When I say it predates the courts. Originally, the Parliament was called the High Court of Parliament. Courts and legislatures were not distinguished. In fact, the role of legislature was actually to declare what the law had always been, so that the king didn't sort of play fast and loose with it, which is actually more recognised what we'd call a court rather than a parliament now. There are obviously the more sophisticated developments since then, and so that we had independent courts and so forth. But I think it's very important that the fourth arm of government, the various integrity institutions, are not there to supplant parliaments, but to ensure that they work better. And parliamentary government must be the heart of democratic governance. And in fact, what's interesting is in the Fitzgerald model, all the reforms went back to Parliament. And that was where the decisions ultimately had to be made. Accordingly, ethics is the normative heart of any integrity system. Parliament is the institutional heart of any integrity system. This, of course, makes political and parliamentary ethics the absolute centre of integrity systems, which is where it should be. The question is, go back to the first set of jokes, is it strong enough to bear that role, and how can we actually strengthen it? Let's actually talk about, I've talked a lot about ethics things. I'm not going to go into a detailed disquisition on ethics, but try to put a few simple propositions. I always like starting with what Peter Singer sees is the basic ethical question, which is, how do we live our lives? That is the fundamental ethical question for him, and I think it's a very good place to start. But of course, how do we live our lives? To me, ethics involves asking hard questions about our values, giving honest and public answers, and trying to live by those answers. If we do, we have integrity, we are true to our values, we are true to ourselves, and if you're not, the first person you cheat is yourself. Note that this particular concept of ethics is about being true to your own values and being upfront and public about those values. It doesn't mean that you adhere to a single set of correct values, or my set of values, or Harry's values, or anybody else's values. It is a question of being honest about your own values. That's, for me, the essence of ethics. It, of course, means that it's not a defence in a court of law to say that, I'm ethical, I actually believe in killing babies. You say, well, that's fine, you believe that, that's fine, and it's my ethics, it's my role to actually sentence you to life. But the point is that it's very important that ethics is seen about actually being upfront and honest, and integrity is about ensuring that you're true to your values that are publicly stated. I put this because we talk a lot about individual ethics, but we don't talk that much about institutional ethics. Perhaps because people think it's too hard, but for me, and what I've been working for most of the last 20 years is on the concept of institutional ethics, which is related to the concept of professional ethics, is a very similar set of questions. How do we live our lives not as individuals, but together? Bearing in mind the fact that we are social animals, descended from social primates, that's my one lane dismissal of all social contract theory, but that we are social animals. Our sociability is a key part of our humanity, and what's more, as said before, even if it's not, we act collectively because acting collectively can often achieve more than acting individually. But if you do create an institution, if you are going to work together with other people in the institution, whether it's lawyers or a particular corporation or a civil service department or a parliament, to me, institutional ethics involves asking a parallel set of questions. You ask hard questions about the value of the institution, you give honest and public answers, and you try to live by them. Obviously, this is in many ways a more complex process than where there's one individual. And it requires leadership within the organisation to actually sort of help pose those questions and lead other people. And what tends to happen, of course, is that you don't get an identity of answers. You tend to produce a convergence or an awareness of difference. And, of course, some people may be so different that maybe it's best that they're not part of that organisation. But nonetheless, the thing is, it's very important that you actually have a debate about what the institution actually means for you and to have a vigorous debate about that. Because actually institutions do actually change, and the values that institutions reflect and support do actually change. You could talk about parliaments. I often talk about universities because they're a little bit older. The first parliament is in Europe seems to be that set up by Simon de Montfort in England in the 12th century. Universities were set up in the West in the 11th century and much earlier in other countries. But however much you dispute the history of it, they've been around for a long time. They've changed enormously from little settlements of scholars who didn't want to be educated in monasteries, often around in market towns like Oxford and Cambridge, but before that in Bologna and the Sorbonne, and that they've changed enormously over the years. And the reason why they've changed is that people say have different views about what they can do. It's not a question of sort of original intent that an institution should stick by the values that it starts off with, because in that case it will die, it won't serve the function. Parliament would still be determining what the law had been, as opposed to the rather more dynamic role that it has today. So it's asking hard questions about the value of the institution, giving honest and public answers, and then living by them. Living by them for an institution means setting up your formal rules, your ethical codes, your formal rules, your institutional structures, to make it more likely that those that having identified the behaviour that is necessary to further the values of the institution, that you make it easier to do the right thing, harder to do the wrong thing, and if you do the wrong thing, easier to detect and quicker to be sanctioned. So that the idea of institutional and professional ethics is actually parallel to that of individual ethics, and it's constructing it's actually asking those questions, giving answers, and living by them. This is how that we actually do it. Asking hard questions of values is actually a question, firstly, of asking what the institution's for, asking why is the institution better off because it exists. As I said, I've gone through the honest public answers and living by them. Political ethics. And this is where, of course, politicians, I think, have an absolutely critical role, not in the integrity system, but in society. Politicians have the role of formulating choices for the electorate as to how public power should be exercised for the good of the community they serve, in presenting them those ideas in open competition and delivering on their promises. Because if, in fact, organisations, certainly governed organisations, are going to sort of... there are different values that they can further, different ends that they can serve, politicians have the critical role of trying to formulate alternative things that public service... and public service institutions can do for the benefit of the community. There is a legitimate debate as to what they should do and how much they can do, and politicians have an absolutely critical role in doing that. They seek to win if they believe, but politicians seek to articulate policy choices, put them before the people, and if they believe that their policies and general philosophy underlying it are correct, they should be proud to do so and to believe that these public values and public policies deserve to be chosen on their merits by their fellow citizens. In fact, in a sense, to seek to win by other means discredit those values and policies and dishonours the profession. If, in fact, you say, well, you know, these really are, you know, you really should follow these policies, these are the values that we should be furthering. In that case, if you actually... You ought to, I think, believe that in open competition that they will win. If not, I mean, basically, there's a key choice here. You either believe your party's policies are right for the citizens who elect you, and all you need is a level playing field to convince them, or else you're unsure that the policies are right for the citizens, or believe that they cannot be persuaded in open competition. And that, of course, if you decide the latter, leads into a very significant and unfortunate slippery slope. I want to make a few comments about different kinds of issues that come up. If that's the concept of the core of political ethics, of actually putting forward value choices for your fellow citizens and seeking to persuade them and deliver on them, there are various dilemmas, temptations and pressure points I'd like to talk about. And I won't go through all of them, but we can deal with some of them in question time. The first thing, I want to make a distinction between dilemmas and temptations. It's a very important and simple distinction. A dilemma is where there are two principles pointing in different directions and you don't know quite which one's going to do. A temptation is the principles point in one direction and you want to go in the other. And of course, the thing is that a lot of people like to dress up a temptation as a dilemma. Dilemmas can be caused by conflicting values that are not resolved. They can be caused by uncertainty, lack of clarity in the ethical norms or novel cases, or a lack of understanding, or just not enough time to think through. In Queensland, we've not through the Fitzgerald reforms, but something that our institute actually proposed, and we're very happy that the Beattie government agreed to it, is the introduction of an integrity commissioner. Originally only limited initially to conflict of interest issues, but the idea was to give general ethical advice to politicians, ministers and senior civil servants. And the idea is a simple one, is that whenever you've got, you know, if you've got ethical norms, they can be uncertain and unclear, just like legal norms. If you've got legal norms, of course, you can go to a solicitor for advice and ultimately it's determined by a court. When you have ethical norms, especially sort of in something as highly contested as politics, that if as soon as you write down an ethical code, then if there's no authoritative means for determining what that code actually means, then it's open slather for your opponents to say you've breached your own code, for the media to say you've breached your own code, whether or not you truly think you have or not. And in fact, this is one reason why a lot of politicians have quite sensibly, you know, have said, what do you do about it? You know, I actually believe in what you're saying, Charles, but what do you do about this problem? And this is actually a response to that, is say, well, you actually create an integrity commissioner whose job it is to give what I call prior advice on ethical issues. And I wrote an article on once called Prior Advice is Better Than Subsequent Investigation. Because, you know, it is, and very important, because you know just how long, if there's an ethical scandal or somebody's accusing you of something, it takes so much time. Much better that you actually have, and it's very important, the Integrity Commissioner to be somebody whose integrity is actually respected by both sides. If you've got an ethical issue, you can take it to them. If you state all the facts and you follow his or her advice, if you state the facts, he'll give the advice, he'll write it down for you in a letter. You don't actually have to publish that letter, but if in fact you are substantive questions, you can say, I stated the facts, I took the advice. Now, of course, if you don't state the facts, you know, if you get to say your kids own some shares in that particular company, or if you don't follow the advice, well, you're toast. In fact, it's intended that you be toast. In fact, there is actually some people were quite smart on the less ethical side of Queensland politics, who actually saw what we were up about, not least because we were totally transparent about it, is that this is actually this provides a guarantee that you won't be attacked for acting unethically, but it does mean that you have to before somebody who does have integrity, who's not going to advise you how to do the wrong thing. He's not even going to advise you what, you know, there's a dividing line and you can just get away with that. He's going to go, these are the facts, this is the right thing to do. It actually means that there'll be higher standards of behaviour, but it means you get a get-out-of-jail card free if you actually follow those higher standards of behaviour. And of course, so you should, because you're nowhere near behaviour that should get you into ethical jail or ethical problems. So there's a deal that can be done, and it's interesting. It started off very slowly. Because a lot of people, I think, probably didn't want to be told to do the absolutely right thing. They'd prefer to do the thing that's dodgy, but just on the right side of wrong. But it's catching on. And what's interesting is the opposition almost immediately said, "Why can't we access the Integrity Commissioner for exactly the same things?" And actually, I must admit, things, because don't get into, if somebody follows an idea you've put forward, you don't sort of go and bite the hand that feeds you. But I must say, I thought it was a really good idea. And in the latest round of reforms done in Queensland, that's been a key part of it. And in fact, the thing is that some people said that the Leader of the Opposition, that all opposition members must consult the Integrity Commissioner. And my own view is that was wrong. It's up to the Leader of Opposition to tell his or her MPs to do it. It's not up to a piece of government legislation to tell opposition MPs what to do, and that's the approach that was actually taken in the recent set of reforms. So the Integrity Commission becomes a really important and powerful structure. I could talk about temptations, and that's about abusing power for personal gain, some of the sleaze issues talked about. There's an abuse power by hanging on to office. And one of the most significant forms of the abuse of power is actually abusing power to hold on to office. Obviously, cancelling elections is something that is done in some countries. Luckily, you can't do it in Australia. Gerrymanders, pork barrellings, donations with a pro for the quid. Government advertising, actually, I think is the last time Harry and I were in the same room as we were both being monstered by the same senator. I was described as having insulted my logic, which has led me to sort of point out that I was actually, it's very rarely that you can actually solve a public policy problem with a syllogism, but this was one of them. That according to everybody, there was a risk that the power over government advertising could be abused. According to everybody, that risk had materialised. According to the Liberal Party, Labor Party people had done it. According to the Labor Party, Liberal people had done it. And according to the Greens and the Democrats, everybody had done it apart from them because they didn't have the power. So you actually had unanimity on two points. A, that there was a risk, and B, that the risk was materialised. Now, it's very, very, very rarely that you can do a syllogism. Of course, the next step of the syllogism is that you should do something about it. I think that, and this is a risk management approach, as soon as you see a risk, and I think this is very important for parliamentarians, if you see a risk like that, you should do something about it. In fact, the thing is, if you see there's a risk of a power that might be abused, then in that case, it's I think there's a bounden duty to do something about it. Of course, there is the answer, of course, is that we don't do it, only the opposite, other side do it. But I did say that this is a rather improbable distribution of virtue. But even if this improbable distribution of virtue was remarkably true, isn't there a risk that you might lose office? And therefore, the very wicked people who would abuse the powers, whereas we don't, would do it. And interesting thing is, one of the things I said there, and it can go through a lot of issues, which I don't think I want. Oh, I do want to talk about lying, because that's fun. But I think it's an important thing. Sometimes there are things which there is such a temptation to abuse a power that you actually take it out of the hands of politicians and give it to somebody else. Very rarely, but sometimes you do. Firstly, there's a question of deciding guilt and innocence. You can no longer have bills of attainder. And secondly, we've actually decided about 20 to 25 years ago, that actually setting electoral boundaries was too big a temptation for politicians to engage in. So most Australian jurisdictions have actually taken it out. And I think that the argument I made then was that we should do the same thing with government advertising, and that's largely happened at the federal jurisdiction, may help nothing. Last thing I want to talk about lying. Everybody likes lying, or talking about it. Because it ties to this central element of the profession of politicians. The central task of persuading the electorate that your ideas are the right ones, the values you put forward for public institutions, the ones to be followed. The chance of persuading may slip into the parliamentary hanging offence, for which unfortunately far too few are hung, of lying or misleading parliament. It's interesting that some people, in most descriptions of ethics, actually put lying and misleading together. Some people make very strong things. I never tell a lie. But some of the things they say might seem a little bit misleading. And I think that's a very important. I put there a distinction between lying is the making of a false statement in order to induce a false belief. Misleading is when you make a true statement in order to induce a false belief. And I think there's a very good reason for not actually regarding the latter as being somehow exonerating and fine. I didn't lie to you, I just misled you. Because actually misleading must of necessity be premeditated. And by being more calculated is in some ways more heinous even than a straight out lie. You can tell a lie in an instant. Misleading actually requires a bit of thought. But of course persuading means making a true statement in order to induce what at least you believe is a true belief. Now you might say, oh, well, we always do that, and somebody said, oh, it's persuading, which is really misleading. The difference, of course, is whether you really believe it. And this is a question of being true to your own values and asking yourself, again, coming back to that thing, there's a really, really important central profession of politics. It's at the centre of our integrity system. The ethics is the centre of the politicians, are the centre of their activities. And the question is, do you really believe it? Would you actually, is it something that you can sleep with at night and tell your grandchildren about in 20 years' time? Thank you.
You spoke about how we should move away from the idea of creating saints.
Mm-hmm.
My question is about the integrity commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like as an individual or the head of a commission, we're actually giving an individual quite a large sort of remit to decide how correct behaviour should be defined. And I'm wondering whether or not, in fact, well, I agree with you that we shouldn't be working towards creating saints, because it's important to have, well, to me, I believe it's important that ethics, especially in politics, reflect the population. And so perhaps it's more important to have an elected integrity commissioner than it would be to have, in that scenario, than it would be to have elected politicians, because you need the commissioner to represent the ethics of the population so that he can ensure that our parliamentarians are behaving in a way that reflects the ethics of the population. And I'm wondering whether or not it's what your view is on when it's really gone full circle, and you might be saying all our government institutions need to have institutional ethics which are built up from the hard questions within them, when in terms of our actual parliament, it comes down to them asking one individual whose integrity is respected how they should behave. I guess there's two questions there. How does the commission know what that behaviour is? And isn't it more important than that person is elected than the person he's sort of giving advice to?
A very good question. Actually, in the obviously there's more to this idea than a couple of lines. The first thing is that of course they're not just sort of thinking off the top of their head. They are working with existing codes. And as I pointed out, of course, the thing is that if in fact if they do start producing this letter afterwards, and if it's seen to be if in fact the general things that that's pretty rum advice. I think that's a pretty stupid thing to say. Or why are you consistently coming out with things that exonerate the government? Actually, a friend of mine who had a similar role in Canada, although the problem there was they said you should have somebody to do advice and somebody to do investigations. And the person who was appointed to give advice was told to do investigations. So it was total confusion. Any lawyer would say that's a stupid thing to do, and it really came unstuck. But the thing is that the first thing you should do is that, of course, there's a publicity issue. And so if the person keeps on coming out with sort of things that are contrary to what others think, firstly, of course, there are the code of ethics could be changed. Because the code of ethics itself should be developed on cross-party lines as far as possible. In fact, I think it's very hard to actually sort of have codes of ethics that don't have cross-party support. Although I don't think that's necessarily that difficult, and it might be better to actually have sort of people who have recently retired from politics as opposed to those who are currently in the fray. But the thing is, so firstly, there's the code. So they're interpreting a code. Secondly, there's the issue of adverse publicity. And in fact, if people don't like it, they can actually the code can be changed. And I suppose, of course, you could always impeach somebody if they are seen to be utterly corrupt or utterly foolish in their decisions. The final thing is that very keen on the idea, and there's some debate in Queensland, because it happens for the head of the CJC, but it doesn't, CMC, but it doesn't happen for the Integrity Commissioner, and that is that they have to be appointed by a parliamentary committee in which there is at least one member of the opposition voting in favour of the appointment. Something it's a bit like the way that the Republicans wanted to elect the Governor-General, to actually have both parties want to actually have somebody who's on their side. But in fact, the thing is designed so you can't. You've actually got to choose the person with integrity. The other thing is, of course, is coming back is the reason why having somebody elected. If somebody's going to be elected, there's going to be a political process. You're going to have to have organised candidates. Organised candidates are provided by the party, and therefore the thing is the Integrity Commissioner is going to be end up representing one party or another. So I'd prefer to have a structure which makes it impossible for them to do it, but not to sort of have them starting off the bat. It's a very good question, and I can show you the article if you want to see how that's dealt with.
Any other questions?
I'd just like to ask you to tease out this issue of whether accountability institutions have some sort of undemocratic effect. I've just been doing some work related to this in Solomon Islands, and one of the questions we were asked was, "What's the use of the ombudsman? He hasn't got any teeth to bite." I answered, "Well, no, he hasn't got any teeth to bite, but he's got teeth to peel back the banana skin and reveal whether the banana's rotten or not." So it seems to me the answer is that, yes, these institutions don't function anti-democratically because all they really do is reveal what is not the aspects of the apparatuses of the state and what they're doing that is not necessarily immediately apparent to the citizens. But that may not be true of some institutions, I don't know. Perhaps some do go a little bit further than simply peeling back the banana skin. And very interested in the idea of an integrity commissioner because, of course, Solomon Islands has a leadership code commission with perhaps a rather similar role. But he has the role of that prior advice, but also the role of doing something about it.
Subject investigation. Yeah. Well, I think that basically you don't want to. If you're going to go along for advice for your solicitor, you don't want the solicitor to be your judge, or vice versa. So I think that's sort of a fundamental sort of rule of law issue about why you should separate the roles. I think the thing is that these fourth arms of government should be seen and justify themselves. They've got to justify themselves too. As making the other institutions work better rather than sort of doing the job themselves. And I do think that it is possible for them to become overmighty. I think one of the arguments against sort of the Hong Kong model is that you create an extraordinarily powerful single institution. Of course, Hong Kong was different because, of course, the thing is that you didn't have a democratically elected legislature or not one with significant power. So in the end, you actually end up having ICAC more powerful because it was taking on almost sort of some of the roles that the mayor democratic elected bodies might do, because the one thing you couldn't have was a democratic elected body, because the troops would march over the border the minute that you thought about it, even before you announced it. So that I think there is a problem, and one of the arguments for integrity systems is that, in a sense, this fourth arm of government power is actually diffuse. Some people used to say to me, well, look, exactly the thing, the Ombudsman has no power. You know, like how many divisions has the Pope got? You know, what's the point of ethics? You know, how powerful are you? I think one of the interesting things in an integrity system that a lot of the elements are particularly powerful. So individually, there's no chance of them running amok. But collectively, they're actually quite strong. And when somebody said the Ombudsman is just a weak reed, I actually came up with a new way of imagining integrity systems. Originally, sort of had a Greek temple with sort of legislature, the judiciary, and so forth, the separate strong pillars. No, actually, they're weak reeds, and it's good that they're weak reeds. That I called in the end my image of an integrity system is actually a bird's nest, several weak reeds which hold the egg of integrity. And the thing is that actually it's good that none of them are really strong, because they themselves aren't going to be the problem. But collectively, if they do the right thing, they can actually preserve integrity. And there's lots of... You can see how this analogy goes. That firstly, they're built of local materials, and so it's not a standard model. And also, the thing is that a few of the reeds can blow away and people think everything's fine. But then if you let too much blow away, the egg falls out and everything goes apart. And the final thing, which I want to sort of really emphasise, and that is that integrity systems degrade and have a natural tendency to degrade, and they degrade for a very simple reason, not because they're made out of twigs that blow in the wind, but because every holder of public office has a temptation to abuse their power slightly in order to retain office, to allow the office to degrade a little bit in integrity to increase their likelihood of retaining office. Now, I say that this is a risk. Some people jump in and immediately say, it's not a risk, every politician would do that. I don't agree with that. But again, all I say, it's a risk, and therefore you should look to it. And that what actually happens is that if you just leave an integrity system by itself and you think you've sold everything, then in that case, it will degrade. And you may have to wait till the next scandal before you get some improvement. Although it's better if, like those who really like the egg that the birds do, they are constantly tendering to it. And there's an interesting question in Queensland. I think we actually noticed that a lot of people were complacent, even though, in fact, there'd been quite a lot of tendering to the nest. And, in fact, the thing is that you suddenly have a wake-up call and that it's not quite as strong as you thought it was. It's better to get a few more twigs.
Yes, the lady in the back row again.
Many as you like.
This time. First question is a follow-up from my original one, and I was wondering...
Supplementary questions are permitted.
Sorry.
No, that's fine.
I was wondering, as you said, it's going to be important for the Integrity Commissioner to have support from both sides of Parliament, but I'm wondering if that's still quite a closed group, so they've got... The Parliament supports the Commissioner and the Commissioner supports Parliament, but perhaps there's still a vacuum as to who's deciding exactly what's right and wrong for either of them to be doing. And then my second one, it occurred to me after the gentleman's question, was I'm wondering if this whole system is really dependent on the parliamentary system or parliamentarians actually being concerned with exposure. So you're actually... It relies on a certain sort of ethical standard initially. If your parliament is corrupt enough already not to actually care if it's found out that what they're doing is immoral or corrupt, then the exposure of that is actually not going to have a huge amount of impact on their behaviour. So I'm wondering how this would apply to somewhere not so fortunate as ourselves.
I think, again, good points. As far as the fact is, if politicians, in a sense, the thing is, the reason why you go into politics is to make money out of it. It's a bit like, there are some places in which you actually enter the army in order to gain political power. You enter politics in order to gain economic power. And the thing is that you, and actually the industry is not very strong because of that. And so there are things where actually that's the case. I think that it's quite a good thing that going to politics is actually a very bad way to make money. Although, of course, some local politicians in local politics, that's not true. But I think that it's quite good that people can't. Although Lee Kuan Yew says the best thing to do, he says he is the poorest but highest paid prime minister in Southeast Asia, that's one argument is to pay them a lot and have absolutely rigorous anti-corruption mechanisms. I actually think democracy is a useful sort of useful thing as well, but I think that it is true that you can get to that thing, and in fact there's some work we're doing. We actually, somebody from the Clean Hands campaign in Italy who really liked our worker integrity system said, Charles, the thing is, I think you should. I think this is really important, but what you should do is you should study corruption systems, because often corruption systems have everything that you'd like the integrity system to have: long-standing relationships, strong institutions, clear norms, positive incentives, and very strong sanctions. And I mean, actually, it's more than just a joke, because the thing is that it actually explains why, when you study integrity systems, some countries with apparently strong integrity systems have high levels of corruption, and some whose integrity systems seem to be quite weak, like Holland, for instance, actually don't have much corruption. And the reason is there's another independent variable, which is the corruption system. To some extent, sort of, if in fact the corruption system, takes hold, it's extremely hard for people to get out of it. We do work in the Philippines now, and one of the things is, how do you break that cycle? Interesting enough, Fitzgerald was a question of breaking that cycle. Because the corruption system was fully entrenched, from the copper on the beat up to the chief of police and the person who appointed him. And so it was actually a classic thing of a corruption system. And so, yes, the thing is that it is a real problem, and I think we need to recognise it. And in fact also recognise that the job of the integrity system is to recognise corruption systems and actually seek to break them, in the same way as a corruption system will seek to disrupt an integrity system. The other thing is that whether, in a sense, as I put it, the Integrity Commission might be in collusion with the parliamentarians. And I think that this is always a possibility, but part of the things in the integrity system isn't just Parliament, the integrity system. It's also going to be hopefully independent judiciary, a strong independent media, watchdog NGOs, and so that if that piece of paper is produced by the Integrity Commissioner and it looks like rubbish, then the newspaper will say that's rubbish, and the watchdog will say it's rubbish. And so in one sense, because you're doing it publicly, transparency is not everything, but it constrains behaviour in some very significant ways. Often the thing is that I don't say transparency is everything, but it's a very useful part of it, and it does constrain behaviour. This business about asking yourself hard questions about your values, giving honest and public answers, the very publicity reduces the number of answers that you could give. There might be some answers that might be true, but there's no point in actually putting them out. But I think that in many ways this is a way you need to... The idea of an integrity system is that you don't just rely on sort of just getting good people in Parliament. You try to articulate what the values are, which is very much, I think, for parliamentarians who care, and probably in both sides of politics they're more likely to sort of come together and agree on sort of higher standards of values, and then say, well, we know what the temptations are. We know what the dilemmas are. How do we structure affairs so that people have a clear idea of what they should be doing because of the code and because of advice, and that it's actually easy to do the right thing, hard to do the right thing, and you'll be found out if you do the wrong thing? And that, if you like, is the essence of integrity system. It brings together ethical standard setting, legal regulation, and institutional design. It's actually what modern governance is and should be about. And there's no jurisdiction in the world that has it perfect. A lot of them have got it quite good, but if they don't continue to work on it, it'll get worse. It'll degrade. And I think that's... I would like to certainly see that the one of the things we say is that the Fitzgerald set up a governance reform commission which looked very carefully at the structure of government to see how its integrity could be improved. Fitzgerald, the one thing that wasn't followed, Fitzgerald recommended that it be a permanent body. He actually recommended the CJC, be created for 5 years and looked at again, because he recognised just how powerful it was, and that, you know, you've got to be careful with any powerful body. But actually the thing is that the Governance Reform Commission, or EARC, the Electoral Administration Reform Commission, I just call it generically a Governance Reform Commission, ultimately it can't do anything by itself. All it can do is keep on producing these reports, which become embarrassing if you don't do something about it. And the idea of actually every jurisdiction having a permanent body, it doesn't have to be huge like EARC. I mean, initially EARC was very large, he's had a big job to do, but the one that continually reviews it is something any jurisdiction should seek to do. No jurisdiction has done it, and that's an interesting question. But that may change somewhere sometime soon.
Okay, this is a very quick last-minute question. No, please join me in thanking your lecturer for that.
Thank you.
Good. We started a bit.